Part 4. Arms and Hands. Chapter 12. Handedness. The bodies were discovered in a heap in the dark and dirt of a collapsed tunnel. 16, 17, maybe 20 dead. Rotted down to their bare bones, some were yellow with age, others charred black, or white as ash. One skull was split, exposing the remnants of its desiccated brain. Nuggets of iron mail, dislocated shield bosses, and a jade-tipped sword hilt had fallen into empty rib cages. Lying amid a tangle of long thigh bones were leather purses filled with coins. The dead had been paid, but they'd clearly not been robbed. Instead, they'd been piled up as a barricade, fresh in the flesh, and hurriedly abandoned. Their bones showed no signs of bludgeoning, hacking, or dismemberment. But in the tunnel, there were ample traces of sulphur crystals, bitumen, and pitch. Death had come to this place not in bloody combat, but in the noxious cloud of a chemical attack. In 256 CE, the eastern Syrian city known to some as Jura and to others as Europus had been braced for military assault. The city had been founded 5 centuries earlier, in about 300 BCE, as a small fortress settlement of the Seleucid Empire, one of the Hellenistic powers to emerge in the aftermath of the death of Alexander the Great. Strategically positioned on the western bank of the mighty Euphrates, Jura had quickly expanded in size and strength, becoming home to a culturally rich and diverse population drawn from across the eastern Mediterranean, Levant, and Mesopotamia. It was an obvious target for competing regional powers seeking control of the busy, prosperous trade of the river. Within just a couple of centuries of its founding, the new city had been subjugated by the powerful Parthians from what's now Iran, before falling to Rome under Lucius Verus, who reigned 161 to 169 CE, in the latter half of the 2nd century CE. But a resurgent Persia was extending its territory westwards under the ambitious Sasanian dynasty, which had overthrown the Parthians and pushed ever onwards towards Roman territory. By 254 CE, they had already sacked Antioch. Now, 2 years later, the Sasanians had their sights on Jura. The citizens readied themselves for the inevitable attack. Temples dedicated to deities of Greek, Syrian, Mesopotamian, Phoenician, and Roman origin were carefully desanctified. Homes were turned into munition stores. Treasures were hidden or removed as most of the city's wealthier inhabitants packed up and left, hoping to return once the enemy had been defeated, as it surely would. After all, the city sat at the edge of a steep cliff cut by the course of the river, and its northern and southern sides were hugged by deep wadis. The city's only vulnerability was its desert-facing western wall, but this had been shored up with a hastily built, thick mud brick bank on its outer side, while the narrow lane, halls and houses on its other side had been filled at great expense by a deep-packed earthen rampart. As a crucial garrison guarding the trading waterway below, the city was also home to over 3,000 Roman soldiers, crack troops of Syrians from nearby Palmyra, and a civilian militia, all tasked with maintaining control of this small pocket of the Roman Empire's eastern frontier. The city seemed inviolable. And yet, camped in the desert beyond its western gate, a Sasanian army was quite literally digging in. Within a few short weeks, long, low tunnels braced with timber had reached the city's western wall. Inside, small teams of Sasanian troops were hacking the large ashlar blocks into rubble, sapping the stone fortifications of their strength. On the other side of the wall, the Romans were burrowing too, hoping to capture their assailants and the tunnels. Beneath the wall, a Roman tunnel broke into a long, narrow chamber from which a Sasanian tunnel descended into blackness. Crouching inside the chamber, a team of at least 20 Romans listened for the enemy. All was suspiciously quiet, until poisonous smoke rose up from below, prompting panicked, terrified cries as it filled the chamber. A few likely managed to scramble back into the city, but it was too late for the rest, who swiftly, horribly, choked to death. Below, the Sasanians had used bellows to fan the toxic fumes of burning sulphur and bitumen up into the chamber. Now, they waited for the screaming to stop and the smoke to clear before climbing into the chamber. There, they hurriedly heaped the dead into a pile to block the inevitable Roman counterattack and scattered straw and scraps of linen laced with more sulphur and bitumen as they retreated, pausing only to set it alight as they reached the tunnel's exit. This chemical attack was just one of a number of coordinated assaults that would quickly overwhelm Dura. Abandoned and broken, the vibrant city disappeared into the dust of the desert for over a millennium and a half, until the impacted earth of those emergency mudbanks was carefully cut away by archaeologists in a series of excavations running from 1920 to 1937. Their work revealed that the defensive embankments had not only entombed the war dead, but protected the buildings just inside the city wall from centuries of erosion. As the dried mud was gently removed, the houses of what became known as Wall Street emerged. Nestled among them were religious buildings boasting airy courtyards and spacious rooms, their interiors decorated with brightly coloured frescoes, stone statues, and multilingual inscriptions. At the southern end of Wall Street, there was a sanctuary dedicated to the deity Aflat, who came from the nearby village of Anath. Next door was a small temple to a Palmyrene high god known both as Zeus Kyrios and Baal Shamin. A block further was a Christian building, perhaps the earliest known church, rich in frescoes depicting scenes from the life of Jesus. And then, just a few minutes up the street, the hand of God appeared. The discovery of a synagogue at Dura in 1932 overturned the long-held assumption that Roman-era Judaism was strictly iconophobic, for the building's sensational floor-to-ceiling frescoes were not only peopled with characters from the Hebrew Bible, but showcased the outstretched arms and busy hands of God himself. His hand was there on the niche in which the Torah scrolls had been housed, reaching down from heaven to halt Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac. There it was again, this time above the niche, stretched out to Moses standing barefoot at the burning bush. Higher up the wall, God's long brown arms could be seen spanning the skies over the waterway commonly remembered as the Red Sea, one open palm casting the Egyptian army into the waves, the other ushering the Israelites across the dried-up seabed. On another wall, the hand of God plunged out of the skies to grasp his prophet Ezekiel by the hair and carry him off to a Babylonian valley filled with the desiccated, disarticulated corpses of Jerusalem's exiles, where the hand conjured body parts back together. For the excavators, the artwork in the synagogue was so staggering that the dig's director, Clark Hopkins, likened the impact of the discovery to surviving a train crash. Once, when I was involved in a train wreck, I had no recollection of the moment between the shock when I was thrown from my seat and when I began to pick myself up from the bottom of the overturned car, he later wrote. So it was at Dura. All I can remember is the sudden shock and then the astonishment, the disbelief, as painting after painting came into view. The images floored the team, leaving them wondering how an ancient Jewish community could so flagrantly, if beautifully, violate its own religious injunction against graven images. For most scholars today, the hand of God in the ancient synagogue is best understood as an appropriated Greco-Roman motif of divine authority, more usually seen in images of emperors and rulers being garlanded with a laurel wreath by a heavenly hand. The hand of God in the synagogue is simply assumed to be a conventional symbol rather than a representation of a corporeal deity. But a rethink is in order. Although the Jewish community of Dura was as cosmopolitan as any other urban population in the Roman Empire, the portrayal of God's hands in their synagogue was not just an artistic device, but a remarkably faithful reflection of the biblical texts and traditions the frescoes depict. Throughout the Hebrew Bible, the hand of God is presented as a powerful part of God's anatomy, manifesting his intervention in the human world. The Jewish community of 3rd century CE Dura inherited this biblical understanding of God's body. He was a hands-on deity who had repeatedly reached into the earthly realm to shape the lived experiences of his people. In a diverse and vibrant city on the edge of empires, this small Jewish community celebrated God's handedness on the walls of their synagogue, painting a picture of a highly sociable, corporeal deity. Of all parts of his body, God's hands had long been the most socially active, because our own are too. Our hands are the body parts with which each of us is most familiar. They're the features we first encounter and explore in the womb, raising them to our mouths to sense their feel and form. Throughout our lives, they're the parts of ourselves we see most often, most of the time, most days. Along with our faces, our hands are the bits of our bodies we tend to leave bare simply because they're so very helpful to our social participation in the world. But while we make things, hold things, touch things, and take things, it's with our hands that we also grasp our sense of reality, our sense of being in the world. Our hands are not simply tools, but sensing organs. With them, we can feel shape, weight, texture, pressure, temperature, vibrations, and stillness. We can perceive comfort and pleasure, discomfort and pain. We can differentiate between substance and emptiness, materiality and immateriality. Our instinctive, habitual act of touching, feeling, and perceiving with our hands is so constant that we're often unaware of it. We don't just use our hands, we sense, see, and think with them too. When we look at an object, we automatically anticipate touch. As one scholar puts it, a knife looks sharp, an icicle looks cold, a hammer looks graspable. As sight and hearing impaired people know, it's with the touch of a hand, a press of a finger, that we experience the world in ways rather more profound than those elicited by our other inquiring senses. Without vision or hearing, writes the philosopher Matthew Ratcliffe, one would inhabit a very different experiential world, whereas one would not have a world at all without touch. Our handedness not only renders us a species of creative action, doers, but beings of tactile perception, relation, and reaction, feelers. I touch, therefore I am. Within the ancient religious imagination, the God of the Bible was no different. He touched, therefore he was. By contrast, a God with unfeeling hands was no God at all. As far as some biblical writers were concerned, any such God could be dismissed as a non-being, an insensate, incomplete, incoherent, unholy idol. In short, a mortal made, handcrafted object devoid of divine essence, like the powerless, incapacitated gods worshipped by foreigners. In the words of one psalmist, they have mouths but do not speak. They have eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear. They have noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel. They have feet but do not walk. It's no wonder God's hands are all over the Bible and the world it presents. And it's usually his right hand that is most active, rendering him a right-handed God, just like most of the deities of the ancient Levant. These gods tended to exhibit the same body language. Enthroned in their temples, the god's statues would hold an open-palmed right hand up to their worshippers. It's a pose beautifully illustrated by the god Ael in one of his cult statues from Ugarit. Now housed in a museum in Damascus, it's only a little over 20 centimetres tall, but it's an object communicating immense status and power. Constructed of bronze and overlaid with gold, Ael is in a seated position, dressed in a long, narrow robe falling neatly to his ankles. On his head is a tall, conical crown, typical of divine kings, adorned with two stylized, curving horns. On his feet, he wears delicate sandals. His eyes are large and lined. His gaze is fixed ahead. His face is composed but serene. His left hand is clasped, suggesting he once held an accessory, now lost. But his right hand is raised up, palm open, fingers together, in a sign of blessing. This gesture of benevolent, divine engagement and sociability was common to deities across Southwest Asia, both in literary and iconographic portrayals. It's a gesture inviting and anticipating touch. Looking at the statue of Ael, It feels almost instinctive to raise a hand in polite, grateful greeting, to press it against the glass of the curator's cabinet, to reach for the touch of a welcoming god of old. As a religious motif, the raised right hand of a deity is a symbol that survived across millennia, from the tomb paintings of ancient Egypt to the iconography of Christ in both Eastern Church and Western Church traditions. And it's nearly always the right hand that's raised. Social anthropologists have long observed that across many traditional cultures, past and present, the right hand is associated with life and all its blessings: eating, friendship, birth, high status, and good luck. The left hand, by contrast, is often associated with death, danger, and misfortune. For many communities, both ancient and modern, this is the hand which does not carry food to the mouth, but instead wipes away feces and urine. In Western societies, this is the hand which gives its name, via Latin, to all that's sinister, literally left. Like Ael of Ugarit, the god of the Bible was rooted in a culture in which the right hand was righteous. It's with his right hand that Yahweh rescues his people from slavery in Egypt. It's with his right hand and arm that he clears the promised land of its indigenous inhabitants to make space for the Israelites. It's with his right hand that he grasps his worshippers. It's at the right hand of God that Christ will sit in heaven. The hands of the divine body thus index a cosmic orientation of the world and its workings. But they also craft that world and shape its workings. Theologically, God is understood to have a hand in the world precisely because he made the world. Biblical writers describe God using his hands to stretch out the heavenly skies like a tent. He moulds landscapes, scoops out waterways, and plants forests and gardens. It's with his hands that he lays the foundations of the earth like brickwork, measures the pitch and height of mountains, weighs the winds, and pours out rain. And it's with his hands, of course, that he also shapes the first human from clay. These images conjure the delicate craftsmanship of a gentle-handed deity, and yet, within the Bible's mythology of cosmic origins, they're secondary to his first violent act of creation, in which Yahweh uses his hands and arms as powerful weapons to shatter, smite, pierce, strike, smash, crush, crack, sever, or punch the chaos monster into submission before pinning its watery body beneath his feet. The violence of this battle and its creative consequences are vividly attested in a biblical poem of the 6th century BCE. Here, a description of Yahweh's role as the maker of day and night, summer and winter, and the boundaries of the world is naturally prefaced by his fight with chaos and the repurposing of its watery body. "You are the one who smashed Yam, sea, with your might, cracked the heads of the dragons in the waters. You are the one who crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the wild beasts. You are the one who cut openings for springs and streams. You are the one who dried up the mighty rivers." The sea dragon was the most prominent of a primordial cohort of rebellious or disruptive divine monsters, at once loved and feared by the ancient gods of Southwest Asia. Born of the oldest generation of deities, long before the earthly, mortal realm had been formed, these monsters embodied all that was uncontrollable, undomesticated, and uncertain in the cosmos. In the world of myth, where the lines of time did not run straight but looped about in misshapen circles, battling a chaos monster in hand-to-hand or hand-to-head combat was essential to the story of the universe, in which an ordered world was necessarily built and sustained upon the gods' ongoing management of disruptive disorder. And as we've seen, it was a conflict far older than the biblical God himself. Yahweh inherited both the battle and its body language from his older cultural cousins, Baal and Anat, both of whom laid claim to the vanquishing of the aqueous enemy. In mythological texts from Late Bronze Age Ugarit, Anat's victory is only briefly mentioned. "Surely I fought Yam, the beloved of El," she boasts. "Surely I bound dragon and destroyed him. I fought the twisty serpent, the seven-headed encircler." By contrast, Ugarit's citizens placed greater emphasis on the triumph of their patron deity, Baal. Embodied in the Baal myths of Ugarit as the sea god Yam, also known as Nahar, river, the fearsome foe is finally vanquished when Baal smashes him on the head with magical clubs acting as extensions of his arms and hands. Baal further subjugates Yam's wet body with his own by gathering his splattered parts to drink him down and dry him up. Conquered, contained, and constrained, Yam is materially subsumed into the world order the storm god Baal has bludgeoned into being. The cosmic dynamics of his victory are celebrated on the Louvre's famous Baal Stela, originally located in or near the deity's temple in Ugarit, showing a triumphant Baal striding across the reordered universe. Under his feet are the mountains of the earthly realm, beneath which are locked the subdued, undulating waters of disorder. His right arm is raised above his head, club in hand, ready to strike should the waters rise up again. In his left hand is a downward-pointing, lightning-tipped spear, its wooden staff budding into leafy life as its blade pierces the boundary between the heavenly and earthly realms. This was the strong-armed pose of menacing might common to warrior gods across ancient Southwest Asia, including the very ancient storm deities Tishpak, god of the city of Eshnunna, and Ninurta, protector of Nippur. Each deity had long been a central character in the monster myths circulating around Mesopotamia. Among the earlier of these, dated to between 2340 and 2200 BCE, is a story in which the gods petition Tishpak to kill a raging dragon terrorizing the land. Tishpak is said to have stirred up the clouds and created a storm as he threw his weapons at the terrifying being. Once dead, the dragon's enormous body, seemingly measuring a staggering 50 miles long, gushes blood for 3 years and 3 months, day and night. Tishpak's reward appears to be kingship over the gods or the city in which he was worshipped as patron. But his impressive victory was eclipsed by the more prominent successes of Ninurta, who described himself as the strong arm in battle. Among Mesopotamia's many deities, it was Ninurta who was most frequently credited with defeating monstrous disorder, often depicted as a seven-headed serpent dragon. The battle itself was a stock feature of Mesopotamian art, whether exhibited in monumental form on the walls and stelae of high-status buildings, or carried by worshippers in smaller, portable forms, such as cylinder seals, stamp seals, and protective tokens. An especially characterful example is a little plaque or amulet dated to about 2500 BCE. Although only 1.5 inches wide, it captures well the cosmic scale of the conflict. Ninurta is down on one knee, straight-backed and determined, weapon in hand, ready to batter the second of the serpent dragon's seven heads. The first is already slumped in defeat, a net or throw stick on its neck, while the other heads rear up aggressively above the god. In literary portrayals of the aftermath of the battle, Ninurta straps the dismembered serpent dragon to his chariot, harnessing its ongoing destructive force for his own use. So much so, he appropriates the name and power of the monster as he brandishes a weapon in his upraised hand. Deluge, indefatigable serpent, hurling yourself at the rebel land, hero striding formidably into battle, lord whose powerful arm is fit to bear the mace, reaping like barley the necks of the insubordinate. By the time the Babylonian epic Enuma Elish had been composed, probably in the 12th century BCE, Babylon's patron deity Marduk had acquired Ninurta's victories for himself. Included among these was the battle with ferocious chaos, here named as the primordial salt sea mother goddess Tiamat, who attempts to put a stop to an ongoing argument in the heavens by birthing an army of monsters, led by her lover Kingu, to overwhelm the world of the gods. The ultimate Babylonian warrior god, Marduk's body blazes with his stifling, fiery aura, while his mighty arms and hands are almost indistinguishable from his weapons of war. He made the bow, appointed it his weapon, he mounted the arrow, set it on the string, He took up the mace, held it in his right hand. Bow and quiver he hung on his arm. Like Ninurta, Marduk's weapons are cosmic chaos themselves. Deluge, of course, is his phallic warbow, while the high winds of a sea storm are his arrows, and captive monsters of disruption and disorder are among the beasts pulling his war chariot. When he finally smashes Tiamat's skull with a staff, the battle comes to an end, but the brutality of Marduk's attack is matched only by the violence wrought upon her dead body. He not only tramples her, but roofs the skies and floors the earth with watery fillets cut from her corpse, makes dewy mountains from her fluid-filled breasts, crafts rain clouds from her saliva, and brings forth the surging Euphrates and Tigris from her gouged-out eyes. The overpowering of this unruly, malicious sea monster marked its domestication at the hand of the triumphant warrior god, who not only subdued chaos, but redeployed its formerly disruptive powers within a newly ordered cosmos. It was a mythic constellation distilled into a single, powerful image Marduk himself wore. In the 9th century BCE, the god statue in Aesigilla, his primary temple in Babylon, was accessorized with a lapis lazuli cylinder seal hung around his neck. Commissioned by King Marduk Zakir Shumi I as an offering, the cylinder was to be rolled into the wet clay sealing the deity's missives. Its imprint showed Marduk towering over a subdued, scaly dragon, and its message was clear. Marduk brought domesticated order to the world, transforming chaos from a monstrous enemy into an obedient companion. Like Ninurta and Marduk, Yahweh harnessed the powers of defeated chaos to take on other enemies, including the disruptive humans drowned by the Great Flood and the anonymous pharaoh reputed to have enslaved the Israelite tribes in Egypt. The biblical story of Israel's escape from Pharaoh is best known for the miraculous parting of a raging sea. It's a place misremembered in later tradition as the Red Sea, but named in the Hebrew Bible as the mythic Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds, a deadly body of cosmic water equipped with dangerous twisting limbs or tails to ensnare its enemies. At first, the parting of the sea seems to be one of a series of magical actions performed by Moses' own upraised hand, along with turning wooden staffs into serpents and the waters of the Nile into blood. But it's the great hand of Yahweh that the Israelites are said to have seen at the Yam Suf, just as a much older poetic form of the tradition embedded within the narrative in Exodus makes clear. Extolling the deity with the cry, "Yahweh is a warrior," it makes no mention of Moses, and instead focuses on Yahweh's victory over watery chaos, here named as the primeval enemies Yam, sea, and Tehom, deep, and his weaponizing of its parts to defeat the Egyptian army. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he cast into the sea, or Yam. His picked officers were sunk in the Sea of Reeds. Deep Tehom covered them over. They went down in the depths like a stone. "Your right hand, O Yahweh, is glorious in strength. Your right hand, O Yahweh, smashes the enemy. At the snort of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The streams stood in a heap. You blew with your breath. Sea, Yam, covered them over. They sank like lead in the mighty waters." The contours of the chaos myth shaped not only the biblical story of God, but the frame of his body too. Throughout the Hebrew Bible, Yahweh's strong hand and outstretched arm are repeatedly praised in ways evoking the powerful stance of a typical divine warrior, whose iconography was so well known across the Levant. Yahweh is presented as a deity of menace, whose arm is raised above his head, his fist clenched, poised to strike. "Yours is an arm with might. Your hand is strong, your right hand raised." More than a biblical turn of phrase, the strong hand and outstretched arm of the God of the Bible was not only a mythic memory of his battle with chaos, but a literary reflection of the Levantine iconography of warrior deities. But the chaos myth was as political as it was cosmic. Warrior gods endorsed the power and might of their chosen earthly kings, who imitated their divine patrons in visual and literary descriptions of their own military prowess. Since at least 3000 BCE, Egypt's pharaohs had portrayed themselves in the threatening pose of the gods, brandishing a mace above their heads while grasping their cowering enemies by the hair. These images were emblazoned on public monuments and private royal furnishings, and verbally communicated in letters dispatched to Egypt's neighbours and enemies, in which pharaohs boasted of their outstretched arm and mighty hand, just as the God of the Bible would later come to do. The godlike menace of Egypt's pharaohs is captured well in a temple inscription at Karnak, celebrating Thutmose III's important victory at Megiddo in what is now Israel, in 1457 BCE. His Majesty set off on his electrum chariot, equipped with an impressive array of weapons, like a strong-armed Horus, lord of action, like Montu of Thebes, his father Amun strengthening his arms. Although Megiddo would come to host other battles, it's no surprise that it would forever be remembered as a site of cosmic combat. This was the place at which an Egyptian god had laid waste his enemies, and a place which would later become known as Armageddon, the very name of which would morph into a cipher for the final apocalyptic war between good and evil. Meanwhile, across ancient Southwest Asia, kings were not only decorating their temples and palaces with imposing images of their gods subduing cosmic monsters, but asserting their own corresponding mastery of chaos in the earthly realm in staggering depictions of their military conquests. Inscriptions refer to kings sluicing their weapons in seawater following a successful military campaign, ceremonially reenacting the divine defeat of a watery foe. This correspondence between earthly kingship and divine warfare is clearly articulated in the early 7th century BCE by King Sennacherib of Assyria in an inscription describing his restoration of a temple. He tells of an image commissioned to adorn the temple gates, showing the high god Ashur going into battle against Tiamat and her brood. Ashur is accompanied by a dizzying host of deities, alongside whom Sennacherib seems to imagine himself riding in the high god's war chariot, as he proudly declares. This is the image of Ashur as he advances into battle into the midst of Tiamat, the image of Sennacherib, king of Assyria. I am the one who conquers, stationed in Ashur's chariot. This royal posturing was beyond symbolic, for a king's weapons were those of the gods. Mesopotamian annals spill over with the boasts of kings claiming to have slain their earthly enemies with the bow, lance, or sword of a patron warrior deity. Images of a divine hand descending from the heavens to gift a king the cosmic war bow point to the ritual use of divine weapons in the earthly cult of kingship, while ritual texts suggest these precious objects, imbued with a magical power, were housed in temples. This was a very ancient aspect of royal religion and is attested across ancient Southwest Asian cultures. Evidence includes diplomatic correspondence between an ambassador in Aleppo and King Zimrilim of Mari, an 18th century BCE city-state in what's now Syria. In a letter to the king, the ambassador confirms that the formidable storm god Adad was arranging for his weapons in Aleppo to be dispatched to a temple in Mari. The weapon with which I struck the sea I have given to you, the deity is reported as telling Zimrilim. Several centuries later, at Ugarit, a prayer for the security of the city was not only directed to Ael, Athirat, and other members of the pantheon, but directly appealed to the god's own weapons, addressed as divine spear, divine axe, and divine mace. Like Yahweh's footstool, these heavenly weapons were so closely associated with the bodies of the gods that they were themselves rendered divine. The religious ideologies underlying human kingship were potently lofty, even in the tiny Iron Age kingdom of Judah. In an oracle seemingly recited at each king's enthronement in Jerusalem, Yahweh promised that the divine arms and hands that could subdue chaos would empower the king himself, so that he too would have a hand in maintaining order in the cosmos. My hand shall always remain with him, my arm also shall strengthen him, Yahweh declared. I will crush his foes before him and strike down those who hate him. I will set his hand on sea, his right hand on river. Mythically seated at the right hand of Yahweh, with enemies pinned beneath their feet, Judah's kings were coached by the deity himself in the art of divine warfare. He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze, the king proclaims in the temple, before gratefully addressing Yahweh himself. Your right hand has supported me, your help has made me great. No wonder Jerusalem's kings boasted of their power to smite kings and shatter heads among enemy nations, smashing them into pieces using the forged weapon and rod of iron given to them by their God. Some biblical texts hint at a royal cult of divine weapons housed within a sacred building adjacent to the temple in Jerusalem. Known as the House or Temple of the Forest of Cedars, its name recalls the mythical mountaintop woodland of the oldest gods, which had once been guarded by the terrifying Huwawa. According to the book of Isaiah, the Forest of Cedars was the sanctuary to which citizens would look when the threat of attack loomed, hoping that Yahweh and the king would arm themselves with their magical weapons should the need arise. And arise it did. In Judah, this distinctively royal ideology of divine warfare would become increasingly difficult to sustain and threaten to disarm God himself.